Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be invited to give a Paul Olson seminar in Great Plains Studies. And I've chosen for my topic today, Engaging Lifelong Learners in Natural History, the land-grant mission of the University of Nebraska State Museum. Now, we've just recently had a lot of land-grant publicity on campus last year. We had the 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act, which was the act that established the land-grant universities, and that was celebrated all over the country, including a major focus here at the Center for Great Plains Studies. Not too many people think of land-grant museum. We think of land-grant universities, but what I'd like to do today is show how the University of Nebraska State Museum, part of a land-grant university, is in effect a land-grant museum, and that we attempt to focus on the same themes and priorities that land-grant universities do, learning, discovery, and engagement. So if we just recall back last year, the Center for Great Plains Studies had the wonderful symposium, The Making of the Great Plains, 1862 to 2012. There was a wonderful talk by Martin Jiske from Purdue University on the Morrill Land Grant Act, Investing in America's Future. We also had a very nice talk by Ed Harvey, director of the Morrill Scholars Program at UNL and professor of hydrologic sciences. And he also talked about reflections on the Morrill Act and the man for whom it's named. So these were part of celebrations all over the country. Well, I'd now like to relate the Morrill vision to what goes on at the University of Nebraska State Museum. So if we consider the land-grant mission for the public good, this has different names. Sometimes we call it research, teaching, service, or learning, discovery, engagement. So discovery and research kind of go together, learning and teaching, and service and engagement. At any rate, it's definitely education and outreach, and it involves also lifelong learning beyond K-20. It's one of the concepts of the Morrill Act was to really bring education more broadly to the whole community. In terms of museums today and other such institutions, we have the term informal science education, which is used generally for education outside the classroom. And this takes place at museums, zoos, and parks, and is a wonderful adjunct to what young people receive in their classroom education. We also, of course, have at the land grant universities, we have extension education and state geological surveys for the practical application of university research, that is translating the research findings from the university and the providing channels for research expertise to go to people throughout the state and to go to the public. I'm a former director of a state geological survey at the University of Minnesota, and which is also a land-grant institution. And third, after informal science education, extension education, and as new adjuncts here, we have technology transfer, another fairly new term. Technology transfer refers to knowledge transfer for commercial production. So today's land-grant universities are very much involved, as always, in research, teaching, and service, but they also, in the case of university museums, are involved in informal science education, extension education, and, of course, we have a big effort at the University of Nebraska on technology transfer. Well, all these themes and objectives, discovery, learning, engagement, or whether you call it research, teaching, and service, it sounds really great, but I wanted to just recall that a multi-component mission, that is a threefold mission like this, also can lead to some vulnerability. They all sound great, but if we have a situation where a university or part of a university is trying to achieve all these, it can also lead to some vulnerability. And what do I mean by that? Well, questions can arise, for example, during a budget cut as to what is centrality to the university's top priorities during a budget cut. So if you have something like a research museum, part of the university, and the university may decide during a budget cut that, for example, undergraduate education is a top priority, then it may be difficult to defend the museum if it does not have undergraduate education as a clear top priority, but instead has a mixed threefold mission. Or we can get questions about whether a university museum is a service unit that is not central to the academic mission of the faculty and courses that are taught. Is the museum more of a service unit? And that has led in some cases to museums receiving budget cuts because they're not perceived to be on the same priority as, say, a traditional academic department. Of course, there are questions about elements like this, museums and state geological surveys, do they belong in a university? Of course, we have standalone museums, we have standalone geological surveys in state government in various parts of the country. So another thing that can happen, because the unit has such a publicly oriented multi-component mission in the land grant context, question is then, does it belong in the university? And this sometimes brings up the whole issue of land-grant universities compared to other academic institutions, say a private institution that does not focus on so much on the public outreach. In the case of a museum in the university, which has a mixed budget like we do, we're just as we have a multi-component mission, we also have a funding mix of state funds, admission fees, donations, and federal grants for research. The question comes up, well, does the museum need state funds on top of admission fees and donations? Of course, the University of Nebraska Museum originally was free to the public, and as state funding was withdrawn and state funds were cut, we gradually have had to institute admission fees, and we have a much stronger program now of fundraising for private and corporate sources. Another question that can arise in a university research museum are, what are the academic expectations of faculty curators? In our museum, we have faculty curators who provide the intellectual leadership for the various collections, such as paleontology or parasitology or entomology. What are their academic expectations? Typically, they are expected to meet the same academic criteria as professors in academic departments who do not have the responsibility of curation. So these are just some of the aspects in which a multi-component mission can lead to vulnerability, even though we can value the multi-component mission of the institution, both the land-grant university and a museum. So these questions that I'm posing for the University of Nebraska State Museum actually nationally also have received considerable attention, particularly because of the anniversary year of the Morrill Act last year. For example, a new book by Daniel Mark Fogel, professor of English and former president of University of Vermont, that being the home state of Senator Justin Morrill, published a book in 2012 called Precipice or Crossroads, Where America's Great Public Universities Stand and Where They Are Going Midway Through Their Second Century, about the challenges for land-grant universities. And so I think discussion and recognition of these priorities and the upside and downside of multi-component missions is a useful way for us to consider the role of the University of Nebraska State Museum within the university. My experience with a land-grant university and budget cuts goes back, for example, to the University of Minnesota, which duly celebrated their 150 years as a land-grant. Excuse me, when I was director, I was in my office one day and I got a call from the dean. He said, the budget's just been vetoed by the governor. You have 1 year until the survey will be completely abolished. So if you can do something in a year to get this overturned, you know, kind of have at it. Well, fortunately at that time, they didn't have many restrictions on the director of the survey lobbying members of the legislature. This never would have happened now, but I basically had to spend a year going to see members of the legislature, getting editorials, getting the water well drillers, getting all the constituents together. And in the end, we managed to get the survey reinstated, and it's happily alive today. But this was an article that was in the American Geophysical, this was a talk that was given to the American Geophysical Union, and I love this. MGS will be abolished effective July 92, and the aid to the governor. It is not based, this decision is not based on the usefulness of the survey's work, which I think is, you know, a very good example. So you can have a unit in a land grant that's doing fine work, but, you know, are they central to the mission, whatever. Next slide. Now, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of what in the museum is known as Black Monday, in which there was a surprise, very devastating budget cut and reorganization in 2003 as part of a university budget cutting that was imposed by a big reduction in the budget by the legislature. So the museum essentially was, the state funding was cut in half, roughly. The museum was lost a lot of positions, and it was restructured in which the all but one of the university faculty who had been tenured in the museum were terminated, and then some of them were rehired in other units. For example, my own department, which is now the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences, the School of Biological Sciences, the Department of Entomology on East Campus, the School of Natural Resources. So this was a time, a year, when I would say the museum came very close to not making it. And next slide. We were not alone that year. The next 2004, I went to the International Geological Congress in Florence, of all places, you know, the great birthplace of the principles of stratigraphy with Steno and everything. And here we are, the staff of the museum would put up a protest poster in their museum to protest the administration wanting to close the Natural History Museum. Next slide. So I'd like to dedicate right off this talk to the staff, all the museum employees now and then, and the dedicated volunteers and the friends of the museum who rescued it in that difficult year and have continued to protect and strengthen it for Nebraska's future. Right now, still, we are working with a number of very key volunteers who have stepped in and volunteered their time to help the museum in areas where the state funding was cut. For example, Professor Bob Call is the curator for botany and heads the Bessie Herbarium, extremely historic herbarium here. The university is part of the museum. And he has, as a retired professor, has basically worked every day as a full-time curator since 2003 to be curator botany. And that's just one example of the way people have stepped forward to help us. We have, for example, Matt Jokel, curator of geology from the School of Natural Resources, Bob Diffendahl. Many of you know Bob has volunteered to be our curator of invertebrate paleontology. Not to mention all the volunteers who help us with special events. Next slide. So following this great trauma, very traumatic year, which is still extremely painful for everyone in the museum who lived through it, the museum was completely reorganized and did a whole new strategic plan and a whole new mission statement to revisit itself. And so if you look at these individual elements of what the museum internally came up with, you'll see a lot of echoes and connections to the land grant mission. Things like discovery, research, teaching and learning, engagement, public service, outreach. Things like Discovery in Natural Science, a strong research program based on the scientific collections, a learner-centered education. We have all the third and fifth graders at Lincoln Public Schools who come to the museum for inquiry-based work that is according to the state standards, meets the state standards, public exhibitions, public service. For the research and also to preserve the state's heritage, collect and preserve organisms, fossils, and artifacts. Stewardship of the natural and cultural heritage of Nebraska, because just like so many things that the land grant mission also has, I mean, this, you could almost say this is almost like a political objective because it evolves much more than what goes on within the museum, but the concept is that the museum's, by promoting public education, the whole idea of land grant universities is that you have an educated populace, and that the educated populace then are intelligent voters and can understand public issues and the importance of knowledge. And finally, recruit and mentor future scientists and educators. Science literacy is a very, very important objective of the State Museum. And stimulating curiosity and discovery about the natural world and the heritage of diverse cultures. Next slide. So that's just a little bit on, you know, kind of what happened to the museum and the vulnerability, both the strengths, I guess you'd say, and the vulnerabilities of having a multi-component mission. I'd like to just have a little bit of some historical tidbits come in, since it's Center for Great Plains Studies, and they always like to get into a little history. So next slide, please. And I'd like to thank George Corner, who is our collection manager for vertebrate paleontology, who does a fantastic job. George, thank you very much of compiling the museum's history. This is a ticket for admission for the first public museum. You probably know museums started with the aristocratic collections of all the aristocracy in Europe and these little private rooms where they had these curiosities. And there was the Royal Society in England assembled a museum, and Nehemiah Grew worked on the first catalog for that. He found that what they pay a lot of money for a giant's leg, turned out to be an elephant's leg and things like that. But at any rate, it's interesting here, the birds and the beasts will teach us, admit to the bearer, Peale's Museum, containing wonderful works of nature. And of course, this ultimately comes from the ideas of the Enlightenment. Next slide, please. And I love this picture, Charles Wilson Peale. It's a self-portrait, it's kind of come in and see my museum type picture. But I don't know if you can see because there's still a spotlight on the screen, but in the back there, under a curtain, is a skeleton of a mastodon that he had excavated. And I'm just going to show a close-up of the bottom part and then where the visitors are in the back. This was the first public museum in the U.S. In other words, it wasn't this little private thing. There's an older museum in South Carolina, I think it is, but they were not open to the public. He was the first person, I believe, to paint habitat dioramas, like for taxidermy animals, like the Hall of Wildlife, the museum. And he also, they housed some of the Lewis and Clark's expeditions. So there's a mastodon tooth in the bottom, and then he's got a curtain over the mastodon in the background. We'll get to that later. Next slide. Again, I'm sorry this doesn't show up with the spotlight on the screen, but there is a mastodon jaw. You can find a mastodon jaw and teeth like that in Morrill Hall, and a picture of him with one of his bones. It's a self-portrait at age 83, if you can imagine. Next slide. So the lady is very interesting. Of course, this is people interpret this as, you know, wonder with a capital W. She is, you know, allegorical in a sense, but she has her hands up. She's looking at the what they call the mammoth was under the curtain, and you can see this was in the upper arcade of all things Independence Hall in Philadelphia. Next slide. Now, Peale's mastodon, he actually got it excavated. This was found in New York State, and he actually arranged for it to be excavated with sort of a backwards water wheel to take the water out of the groundwater out of the excavation. And the mastodon actually is still extant. It ended up in Germany, was bought by a German aristocrat after Peale's Museum went bankrupt, and it's actually now still on display in a public museum in Germany. Next slide, please. And there's a very interesting story about the mastodon that goes even beyond it being in the first public museum. We have in our Morrill Hall, of course, the wonderful exhibit of mammoths, or Archie the Mammoth. And the mammoth teeth, as I always have to teach my students in geology of national parks, the difference between a mammoth and a mastodon, the mammoth teeth look like a washboard, the flat top. Next slide, please. The mastodon teeth, though, are sort of conical shaped. And if you ask children who come in to look at the mastodon and you say, do you think it was? Did you think it ate plants or ate animals? They usually will say, "Well, you know, it's carnivore. It ate animals because it has sharp teeth." Next slide, please. So this it has an interesting tie-in with how the museum that Peale had treated the mastodon, which they called the mammoth in those days. At first, they constructed it with the tusks up. Then, you see, 1816, the tusks are down. The reason is that the sharp teeth of the mastodon, the jagged teeth, meant to them it was a carnivore. Therefore, it was this gigantic carnivore in the American West. They didn't know they were extinct. And so America suddenly had this fantastic, you know, death-eating dinosaur type thing, which, in order to make it look fiercer, they put the tusks down. Okay, so the very interesting thing of trying to, you know, appeal to the public mood, and we even get into arguments within our museum today. We have an exhibit called Bizarre Beasts, and are we being too sensational? And is it, you know, and we don't have animatronic dinosaurs, and people say, why don't you have a moving dinosaur? And other people say, well, you know, that's not really our museum. So it's interesting to see this kind of question as to how to present a fossil goes way, way, way back. Next slide. And this kind of question comes down even more recently. This is a completely different kind of animal, but the geologist in 1899 found this strange spiral tooth thing. Okay, so where did it go in the animal? Did it go on its nose? Or did it go on its tail? Or did it go on a fin? So various hypotheses. Next slide. So the original, they had it sort of going up like an elephant's trunk, I guess. Then a lot of other paleontologists decided, no, it's got to be down. It still looks sort of like a mythical beast on the right. And then there's another reconstruction here on the lower left of these mysterious fossils. Next slide. So the problem is, if you have just a fossil, and here's the one from Morrill Hall, one from Nebraska that was collected from Cass County, an amazing spiral tooth. So our artist for Gary Staub for our Bizarre Beast exhibit, this is his version with the spiral tooth in place in the jaw. And our curators decided that in the face of the newest finds are that it didn't have a really long nose, so we actually had to have Gary Staub shorten the nose to be more authentic. But this is kind of a stay tuned to see what's going to happen to the spiral tooth. And it's sort of interesting because the same thing, you know, like the mastodon, did the tusk go down or the tusk come up? Where do you put the spiral? Next slide. Well, land grant, I want to just switch gears slightly back to we had a little bit of a thing about public museums. Now I want to go back to land grants and how the land grant universities had an impact on individual lives. And I actually I said I was a land grant girl. I have sort of a personal story here. You'll notice the Nature, Book of Nature with the rays and the California seal with the book, Open Book, Let There Be Light with rays. Next slide. My grandfather actually, his life was changed by the Morrill Act because he was the son of a co-owner of a small lumber store who never would have been able to go to college except for the land grant opening up the University of California. So he enrolled as a freshman, and at age 17, after the summer after his first term, he went on a field trip to Yosemite with Professor LeConte, one of the great geologists of the era. Next slide. And on the field trip, they spent a week with John Muir. You know, talk about outreach. So at that time, LeConte was there because of the land grant as well, because he'd had quite a nasty war in the Civil War, and then lost everything in the burning of the area in South Carolina where he lived. And so he was basically a refugee, and California was suddenly hiring with this new university. So he and his brother got jobs at Berkeley, to the consternation of people who wanted the jobs, and said that the university is being made into a perfect asylum of ex-rebel professors. But it turned out that this week in the Sierras with when my grandfather was along, was the beginning of a lifelong friendship with John Muir. They were co-founders of the Sierra Club in 1892. LeConte also, during his career at Berkeley, acquired many of the important paleontological collections that are now in what's called the Museum of Paleontology at Berkeley, which is the largest university paleontology museum. And I love this. Muir said, LeConte, riding with loose dangling rein, allowing his horse to go, is like keeping running all-day lectures, which must have been something. And as if trying to be the tongue of every object in sight, in other words, the rocks that couldn't talk, you know, LeConte was saying what they were. And in the evenings, blending art, science, philosophy, whatever we'd seen. You know, typical geology field trip. Next slide. And here's a letter where John Muir, in another letter to somebody else, said, just returned 10 days ramble, the most glorious season of terrestrial grace. But here's a letter he wrote to LeConte with a drawing of a rock that had been cut by a glacier. And at that time, the Geological Survey of California did not agree that Yosemite Valley was caused by flowing ice. Now, LeConte had spent time with Agassiz at Harvard, and Agassiz from Europe had this idea of ice carving things, but at the time of this field trip, Muir was more onto the ice thing than LeConte was, but gradually LeConte came around to it. So it's just an amazing thing. Here's a brand new land grant university. The professor's there because of the land grant, and my grandfather was there because of the land grant. But just to illustrate how important and what a changing experience this was for individuals to have the opening up of the land grant universities. Next slide. And the very next year, 1871, was when our museum was created, the university cabinet. Notice they went back to the aristocracy of the 16th century, who had rooms as cabinets of curiosities, and they called the museum the cabinet. And of course, at first, it wasn't open to the public. It was really for the use of the faculty and their teaching with their students. We just had a wonderful celebration of 140 years of our museum. As our associate director, Mark Harris, said, don't wait until 150, let's do it now. So we celebrate our 140th and going on to the next generations. Next slide. And Bessie Herbarium as well, 1874, with Bessie, who's now in the Hall of Fame at the state capitol. Again, you can see all this tie-in with the state and outreach. Excuse me, next slide. So, Morrill Halls, just moving on a little bit with land grants. We had if you go to other land grant universities, you'll see Morrill Halls, like the administration at Minnesota is in Morrill Hall. So, I felt right at home coming to work at the University of Nebraska. Next slide. And R. Morrill. R. Morrill, of course, is Charles Morrill, who was, I guess you would say, kind of a distant cousin of Justin Morrill, who was earlier. But this really illustrates that from the very beginning, our museum was a public-private partnership, because Morrill contributed his own money. He came to Nebraska and very impoverished, but then he made a lot of money with land transactions and so on. And so he became a regent, and then he gave money, you know, giving back. He says, a debt he should pay by contributing something to the future benefit of the community. And so he generously funded the paleontological expeditions of the university at the time when there was no funding available otherwise. Excuse me, next slide. And of course, Morrill worked very hard to get a building for the museum. And I just love these pictures. They just look like, you know, something, the classical mode, just sort of plopped down on the prairie. Look at this picture of the Field Museum. They look like they're just walking out in the wilderness of course, Morrill Hall, really wonderful picture of our Morrill Hall, which, as the university would like to have it, no parking lot in front. Next slide. And in fact, Davis Design is celebrating their 100 years. Mike Zeleny just sent me this. I didn't get the brochure, but they have in their brochure here in Lincoln, they're actually doing our consultant for looking for us to be able to have a proposal development for our facility to have our alcohol specimens. But at the time before the Morrill Hall, Davis Design and Barbour traveled to other museums, and before that, Morrill had traveled to other museums to get an idea of what to put here. Next slide. Of course, another kind of really good tie-in with the State Museum are Barbour's sketches, which ended up with the beautiful mosaics in the bottom of the floors of the State Capitol with the paleontological animals. Next slide. Going back to the mastodons and the mammoths, here is a sketch by Barbour and the resulting mosaic by Hildreth Meir in the State Capitol. So we have a really nice, again, beautiful outreach with the museum to state government. Next slide. So the museum today, I think many of you are familiar that we have things like the planetarium. We have a lot of outreach programs. So I'm going to use the rest of the talk to kind of talk about the museum today and kind of what's going on, and to maybe tell you some things that maybe you're not aware of that we're doing. Next slide. Our key, of course, for our future was getting reaccredited. When I first became director of the museum in 2003, when I would meet people around the country about our museum, they'd say, there's no way you're going to get reaccredited after that budget cut. There's just no way. And that's where the staff and volunteers really stepped up, and we basically worked for 6 years. Fortunately, the university had kept up with the paperwork and had just done extension after extension after extension, and then we got reaccredited in 2009. So we've had no break in our accreditation for our museum since the program was first established nationally. So this was absolutely critical, was getting reaccreditation. Next slide. And now we've also really tried to ramp up on a terrific amount of publicity, of events going on. People are aware. The first year or two, we had a lot of people thinking the museum was closed, and that it ended with the budget cut. So we had to first rebuild our visitation, and now we continue to try to expand it. Next slide. The friends of the State Museum, our friends president, Art Ziegelbaum, and all, a number of the other friends that are here in the audience today, but the friends provided a vital support group for the museum, both during the really dark days right after the cut, and also they helped us when we had the accreditation site visit, and now they are embarked on a whole new launch of more fundraising for the museum. Next slide. Of course, science education is one of our most well-known activities in the museum. We have one of the first things we did right after the budget cut was we had a private gift from Betty Marks, and we were able to put a little recreation of the Ashfall dig site into the first floor of the Morrill Hall, so that we kind of brought our Ashfall branch to Lincoln. Next slide. We also had a major gift from Ted and Colleen Hubbard in Omaha, and they gave us a gift for an educational kit about elephants, going back to all the way to Peel and his mastodon. We've got all the things about teeth and all that in it, and you can see actually up in the top, we've got the mastodon teeth and the mammoth teeth to teach kids. These have complete teacher guides. This was all privately funded. And the Hubbard said, well, you know, we'll see how you do with this. And our staff just knocked themselves out on this project. And it was so good that then the Hubbards gave money for the construction of the new rhino barn at Ashfall Park. Next slide. Of course, Elephant Hall and Morrill Hall is kind of our iconic space, with Archie both in the statue out front and in the parade of elephants. You can see there's a little bit of the, we've got the largest, most, the lady like this back in 1820 feel about the museum, because that's just about what visitors do when they see the mammoth. So we are following in a long tradition of having spectacular fossils mounted in a museum. Next slide. And behind the scenes, our staff works with amazing collections. It's only a very tiny percentage of our collections are on display in the display parts of the museum. We have in Nebraska Hall collections that back up all the areas in the museum, like entomology, parasitology, botany, I've already mentioned, paleontology. Here is an example. Next slide. The research that goes on in the museum, I'll just show a few examples. Professor Brett Ratcliffe, of course, is head of what's called Team Scarab, has had major National Science Foundation funding for work on scarab beetles, and we actually have a collection from the Smithsonian that's on long-term loan to the Nebraska for upgrading in our museum. Next slide. This spring, talk about outreach, Brett organized an outreach in Peru where they ran a course with students from many different countries on scarabs. Next slide. And let's see, 28 students, he puts in quotes since he felt they were too advanced to be students, but 10 countries, 4 continents, ranging undergraduate student to retiree, good lifelong learning there. But all the lectures now are available online from this short course. So that's a very good example of international outreach for the museum. Next slide. And of course, that group has also been active in our Sunday with the Scientist program, where we have both groups from within the museum and outside in the community present to our visitors. So Beetlemania was one of the most popular ones until this most recent one, Sunday with the Scientist, on spiders and eight-legged encounters broke all records on Sunday. Next slide, please. Here's another example of NSF-funded research. So there really isn't any difference between the type of research that Ratcliffe's group does in entomology or Scott Gardner's group does in parasitology with what they're doing in the museum and what they would be doing in any sort of an academic unit on the campus. I mean, it's the same sort of peer-reviewed basic research that goes on within a research museum. And so this, example of Brett's grants, $480,000 from the National Science Foundation, which funds both basic research plus graduate and undergraduate science education, graduating people with graduate degrees. Next slide. Here is another grant that Scott Gardner had for Mongolia, a huge project on parasites in Mongolia, again funded by the National Science Foundation with major outreach back here with middle school students learning about parasites as part of this project as well. Next slide. Another different kind of international outreach was our Miss Mie thing, where we have a doll that was given to the museum in 1928, and the Mie prefecture in Japan funded having the doll come back to Japan, accompanied by one of our staff members, Susan Curtis, for a year's conservation and exhibit. And over 30,000 people saw the doll there in things from department store exhibits and other kinds of exhibits. The doll was conserved at the top doll company in Tokyo, where, I mean, they made the doll that was given to Princess Diana when she went to Japan, was given a doll. Next slide. So those are examples of the international outreach. We also have, I guess, what you'd call in-state outreach with our two branch museums. And I'm afraid I was giving Rick a bit of a hard time on the top 50 ecotourism sites, which I think should include Ashfall. So next round, I expect more lobbying. So I was saying that Ashfall Fossil Beds actually is on, I think it's the top 10 Evo tourism copyright, evolutionary tourism sites for the Smithsonian. And so they have a world map showing sites all over the world with Ashfall. So then we should have one of the Great Plains with Ashfall on it. So anyway, just a little thing to pick up there. So our two branch museums are Ashfall near Royal and Trailside, which is out at Fort Robinson. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, Ashfall, that elephant trunk kit, the fantastic way our staff did a job on, doing those elephant kits. Then the Hubbard family and their foundation gave money to expand the rhino barn because the skeletons, in order to be excavated from the ash, have to be protected. Otherwise, they'd erode away. So this was a major accomplishment there, over $1 million to construct that facility. Next slide. the Trailside Museum of Natural History. One of the other things we've done since in the last 10 years is, and I still remember going over to the director of the Historical Society and asking them to please look up the blueprints for this building, because there was a stage in it, and we needed to take the stage out in order to put in our Clash of the Mammoths. So we had to show that it was originally a gymnasium, not a theater. And so he found the blueprints, and so therefore it was historically preservationally possible to remove the stage and make the space big enough for us to install the world's only Clash of the Mammoths. This was Mike Voorhees, our emeritus professor of paleontology, as a student, UNL student, worked on the excavation of these, and they had been in Nebraska Hall for years, and we finally raised enough money to get them installed at the Trailside Museum, which is at Fort Robinson. Next slide. So basically what we try to do in our museum, along with all this outreach and land grant stuff, is we really try to bring the past alive with paleontology, because I tend to emphasize paleontology more when I give a talk about the museum, and I probably should talk more about beetles or other aspects, but it's just kind of close to my heart as a geologist. And we have this wonderful, incredible world-class site at Asheville, where the preservation of the bones is so delicate that the paleontologist can see the very fine structure in the bird toes and things like that, which are necessary to tell what kind of birds they were related to. And we've just had a brand new paper come out on a vulture at Asheville, which is very important for understanding New World and Old World vultures. So this is one of the most dramatic birds. It's actually a hawk that evolved to look like what's called a secretary bird, which you can see in zoos. Next slide. Well, I want to just reinforce this idea of what runs all the museum and all this education and outreach. The restructured museum, roughly speaking, it's about, a third now. State funding, federal funding, and then private gifts and endowment income plus admissions. And, of course, any budget, then the question is, well, if you have the private gifts and endowment income and you have admissions, why do you need so much state funding? Why can't we just cut the state funding? Or if we have a sequestration event in D.C. and it changes all the success rates on the NSF proposals and then it cuts back on the federal grants, then how are you going to make that up in terms of the budget? Next slide. And just as in Morrill's day, the private giving to the museum is incredibly important. And it's a little bit like going back to that first public museum. There was a private individual, Charles Peel, who put a tremendous amount of his own personal resources into that. So these museums have kind of been this public-private from day one. Since the campaign for Nebraska started, I'm proud to say that we've had almost $3 million in gifts to the State Museum, which is, our goal was one. So we've had a tremendous response to the campaign, and we've had almost $2 million in addition to the endowment. So the total museum endowment now is $4 million, and so we actually use some of our endowment income to fund staff whose positions, the funding for those positions were lost in the state funding budget cut. Next slide. And I also want to put in a plug for incredible support from the university for the museum in this period, because business and finance, which includes facilities management and planning and so on, you think about what they've been doing. They renovated security system in Morrill Hall. It didn't even have crash doors when I came. A new roof, a new elevator, a new accessible entrance, and we're going to get new carpet. So many of you know carpet is awful right now. And they gave us assignment of major space in Nebraska Hall basement to transfer the specimens from the reunion building prior to the accreditation visit, which was critical for us getting reaccredited. Next slide. And, of course, very important attendance. Now, again, with museums, are you focusing too much on attendance? Are you doing infotainment instead of research? You know, the constant tension between how much are you doing that is what real science versus how much are you trying to appeal? And, I mean, you could say the same thing for Peel's museum, because he started out with just artwork, and then he found that the mastodon attracted more visitors than anything. So that he went in more into the mastodon. So I mean, these questions about, you know, trying to find a balance and get income from various sources is still with us. just this month, we just had an all-time record for our Sunday. That's just 1:30 to 4:30 on a Sunday afternoon, 847 people. That was an NSF, National Science Foundation, funded outreach event with in which they actually bought spiders to show to people. And it was a tremendous success, run by a professor in biological sciences. Next slide. So I guess I might as well get into the sequestration debate, because I feel that sequestration is a major threat to the museum, and it's, what do they say, it's like a delayed release pill, and is it for many things, you know, in our economy, it's something that maybe the impact isn't seen right away. But depending on which administration officials have been persuaded to talk, the cuts to NSF are going to be maybe something like 5 or 8% this year. So if there's a cut like that, then it doesn't sound so big, but it means that the success rate for everything we do becomes harder, and it means that the competition is more. And then all the people who can't get funding from other sources try to go there. So it is going to have an effect. And I love this. This is in The Hill, where this is an article about how all the big guns are lobbying about the sequestration. It says, no interest is too small. In other words, museums, down at the bottom of the, this tiny little thing in the corner, even they're worried about sequestration. But, of course, it's a big thing to us. But I just wanted you to think about this, because I think you all know if there is a percentage budget cut in the state budget or in the university budget, then it kind of gets passed down. Next slide. There's some really interesting things that we just want to mention quickly from our museum association that does the accreditation. And I really like this one. They did a survey to see what the people who really support museums, whether there's something about them. And I wonder whether you can identify this. Nearly all the people who are strong museum supporters have a distinct memory of a specific seminal museum experience, usually between the ages of 5 and 9. Did anybody have an experience that you remember? Art, I know you did. So I think that we do, many of us can identify with that. I know it's true for me. And so the things we do with children are just so important, I think. You just never know when something's going to click with a child. Next slide. I really like this picture. This was when we had some little people looking at snakes for our snake Sunday with a scientist. Next slide. And this was at Ash Fall. The Hubbards paid for a building called the Discovery Station where people can watch fossils being worked on. And I took this picture of Mike Voorhees letting a third grader uncover part of the shell of a turtle that's 14 million years old. And he just got the biggest kick out of that, you would imagine. Next slide. And we need to consider lifelong learning. I just show this as one example. Again, point to Shane and also Kathy French, our education coordinator, who do a lot of outreach. This is the Sand Hills Discovery Experience. And I just took these are the tribal kits from the museum that were there being used by people investigating, and then Shane led a field trip for them to actually do excavating and dig and find fossils that would go into the collection. Next slide. Here's another example of how the museum ties in with campus units. This one is the Center for Materials and Nanoscience. They have presented both at our Sunday with the Scientist events and at our annual astronomy day. The same idea of having direct interaction with the university scientists and family, children and families and people of all ages. Next slide. Our planetarium, of course, we have natural sciences programming, we have special events, we have things related, we have shows related to biological evolution, but then also we're doing like dark matter is one that's on right now. Many of you know we have the full dome projection system now in the planetarium. Next slide. And I didn't realize it here, but Mike Strumpler, you want to stand up? Well, this gentleman been kind enough to loan us the Bayard meteorite, a meteorite that we actually have in Morrill Hall on loan in our meteorite exhibit. And I can tell you that ever since the Russian meteor thing this week. There have just been people all over that exhibit. This is an exhibit of minerals and meteorites that was curated by Matt Jokel. It's an outstanding exhibit, and people from my geology department just love it, because if you had sort of some of the strict museum people say the text is too detailed, you know, because there are always these arguments about how much detail you put in the text and so on. But everyone loves the meteorites, and there have just been people crowded around the meteorites ever since that day. And so we really we owe a lot to Chadron State loan meteorites. We've had private people loan meteorites, and this is just so important for the public to actually see these things and be able to relate them to the news today. Next slide. Here's a scene that I hope NSF will love. This was a scene on Sunday where the research papers that Eileen Hebbets does, she often reports on contrasting behavior of spiders on two substrates, whether they're on filter paper or whether they're on a piece of granite. In other words, whether they're getting signals of prey walking around that's jiggling the filter paper, or whether they don't get those signals, known as seismic signals in the spider world. And so here she had all these families taking notes on their own spider. They each had a different substrate, and they were all taking research notes, and then they went to a station and they turned them in, and then they made a bar graph of what was reported. So, I mean, it's a very, very imaginative way of having people participate in a little research project in a setting like this. Next slide. Well, if we just look at the lifelong learning and science literacy challenge, we have changing population. I just want to talk a little bit about the future. Of course, the initial land grant, we think of all the farmers who didn't have access to higher education and didn't have access to technical information, how the land grant mission helped get the information out to them and helped to expand science literacy in the country. So I think we have some real interesting challenges coming up of targets that we need to look towards. One is we have a lot of focus on young people in the museums, practically all museums, and it was a good reason, because it's those formative experiences. But we also have the lifelong learners, and we do things for the lifelong learners like the OLLI program. We've had Kathy French has run a number of the OLLI programs, and our staff has volunteered for these. They've been extremely popular. And so we have a whole audience there where we're going to need to look to expanded land grant outreach. Next slide. This is a really more sobering chart that was put out by the AAM Center. Just as in the land grant, you probably know in the land grant history that there was the initial land grant Morrill Act, and then there was funding made available which led to the historically black colleges and universities, and then the Native Americans. So museums, look at this, core museum visitors today, 9% minority, where our population is going in a very different direction from where we are today in terms of a land grant mission of reaching, of accessibility and outreach to the population. Next slide. We have had a wonderful gift from Ann Hubbard that enabled us to renovate the Native American Gallery in the museum as kind of a start, I guess, curated by Alan Osborne at UNO. And we'll be launching later this year the first Hubbard Lecture, which is funded by Ann Hubbard, which we're going to have a Native American lecturer brought to campus. And thank you very much, Rick Edwards, and other people on campus from various units are collaborating with us on planning for that, such as Sheldon and other units. Next slide. Here's a start, one of Judy Diamond's projects, in which the posters are in Spanish and several other languages, including we had one on the wall in Arabic, which has had a lot of appeal for some of the visitors in Morrill Hall, because we don't have anything else in Arabic at the moment. Next slide. And basically, Judy's projects have really reached some of that audience that goes beyond the 9% museum audience that you showed on that we showed on the table, because she has had these projects like the outreach to the Omaha Public Schools through the Science Media Project. She had, the World of Viruses, which has had apps done and comic books and all sorts of unusual, or not so unusual, but innovative ways of reaching new audiences, going beyond what the museum normally does. Next slide. Here's an HIV comic strip produced by the museum with funding by NIH and the Institutes of Health. Next slide. And we're going to be celebrating, if we have a friends meeting on Friday after the blizzard, which I hope we will, hope we'll be open Friday, the Tree of Life table. This is a project we've done with Harvard University, in which the computer scientists have done an extremely innovative way of with using fractals of, so you can sort of fly through the Tree of Life. Next slide. And I just took a picture. These are people just sitting at the table a few days ago, and nobody had told them what to do. And there are no instructions at the table. They're just, you know, using it. And so what it does, the idea here is that you can take over on the side, like you can take a picture of a flamingo and a picture of a stegosaurus, which is just down the hall in our dinosaur gallery. And you put them in two little boxes. You just move them to two little boxes. And then this flies through the Tree of Life to then come up to where their common ancestor was. So this shows that birds and the non-avian dinosaurs had a common ancestor, going back, then of course going further back in geologic time. So I'm going to have my National Parks class in there on Tuesday, and we'll see how they do with it. Next slide. The Omaha Science Media Project was a very innovative project with Nebraska Educational Telecommunications, which involved Omaha Public Schools and was really using, getting students engaged in doing media projects. Next slide. Mike Farrell, NET, doing a workshop training students to make little media segments on using science. And so it's a very good way to engage students of that age. Again, reaching a group that we're going to have to do more reaching in the future. Next slide. And of course, Sunday that the Scientist is a tremendous way to reach people. And we have not only museum presenters, but we also have community science groups, conservation groups. Here's one with, we have the UNL Water Center, and there's Stephen Ducharme with the UNL Department of Physics. So now we're getting more and more units on campus who want to have a Sunday with the Scientist, and then they put it into their broader impact part of their National Science Foundation project. Next slide. And coming to Morrill Hall in 2014, we have Titanoboa, the monster snake. We have the new curator for vertebrate paleontology who's worked with the Smithsonian, collected the world's largest fossil snake in Colombia, and the mock-up is coming to Morrill Hall. Next slide. So, bottom line, I guess our mission is really science literacy accessible to all. It says it's a mammoth. But the idea here, I think it's we very much are in the land-grant tradition of accessibility and openness and creating educated citizens for democracy, you know, all those good things. Next slide. So enjoy and support your land-grant museum. Excuse me. I showed you my grandfather on a field trip. So here I was, 2003, right after becoming director, collected a little jaw for the collection. And next slide. Discover, learn, engage, take your land grant mission to heart. Thank you.